So can I offer, Andrew, would you like to pick up any points?
Well, firstly, echo what you said about the quality of the presentations. I mean, I think from our point of view, in a sense, it's reassuring that obviously at the point we're at in our inquiry, a lot of this echoes. But I think, Pete, in particular, you summed it up in relatively few words, but you captured all that's there, and you even picked up the canary in the coal mine thing, which we've been discussing ourselves. And I think, you know, hearing you, you know, it seems so obvious and so simple, but I think the thing that really struck me about your presentation were the quotes from the 1936 thing, because I think that is very telling, and I think it's quite striking, not just the similarities in the sort of percentage of income going on food and so on, but I think certainly from my perspective we've been thinking that some of these issues now, you know, are not the issues that were there before, because we are now talking about poverty as relative poverty rather than absolute poverty. But I think looking back at that reference point, actually we have not come as far as we like to think we have. And I was very struck by the thing about the quality of diet. I mean, people are not literally starving, but they are having diets that are actually compromising not just their well-being, but also for children, their development, and their capacity. I mean, that is a third world type situation where people are prevented from fulfilling their potential economically and in other ways that will help them get out of that situation. So I think that's a very salutary reminder of that. Now, the real question is what we do. I was interested in some of the things about, I mean, obviously we've come to Scotland. Are there specific things in Scotland? I mean, my perception is that the generality, probably not. I think some of the things you said about, you know, right to housing and some of the traditions of sort of support and so on in Scotland probably are slightly different. I mean, I just wonder if there are particular insights that we can draw out that would have a greater application from the Scottish experience. So, that would be my question. What would you offer as a particular insight that, from your experience on the ground here, and that's a question for all three of you, really, that would have a wider application elsewhere in the UK, if that's clear enough?
Go on, Pete. Kick off.
I think, both Martin and Marianne picked up on this, I do think a unique strength Scotland has, and it does come clearly out of Scottish Diet Action Plan in 1996, is this the strength of the community food movement. You know, I don't think there are other, you know, there's probably more local food in England, although, as Martin says, that has become horribly class-based in some places, and that was an issue. But this sort of community food movement, which is sort of genuinely rooted in communities, I think is something which has come out of the last 20 years' work of the community in Health Scotland. And actually,
sorry, can you say that more slowly and louder?
Yes. So
the community
food movement.
Yeah. No.
Has come out of the Scottish Diet Action Plan from 1996, and Bill Gray's work and others that have built on Bill's work. So you do have, I mean, hundreds, I would say, of small community food organisations working away. And I think what that's meant is when this sort of assault of sanctions has come along and pushed people into destitution, actually there's been a bit of an infrastructure to pick up on some of that, so that I think your research showed, Marianne, that in the urban areas much more of the sort of emergency food aid was coming through established groups rather than through the sort of new franchise of the Trestle Trust. And I think that is a difference that I think maybe we, you know, it's an asset we have to build on.
Where does that come from? Is that the populations are less mobile? Is it a legacy of the sort of the structures that grew up around the older industries? The industries may not be with us anymore, but those communities and people living in those localities still are.
My history of it is simply that in 1995, the then Scottish government, well, it wasn't the government then, it was a Scottish, whatever it's called, executive, reviewed Scotland's diet because of the history of poor diet in Scotland. And one of their recommendations, they made much more far-reaching recommendations that didn't go into practice, but one of their recommendations was they should employ somebody to work with communities to do something about it. And that person was Bill Gray. And as a result of that, there have been these, and because of funding usually from the health service, and not exclusively, but what the health service has put relatively small amounts of money into these community food projects, which at least provide a sort of neighbourhood focus for food work and communities.
I quite like that idea. I'm not stopping it, but some of the things you said between you and you latterly as well about the community thing, people cooking for other people and local food and growing and so on. I mean, I don't think we discussed it as a commission, but there's an example in Bristol, I think, of people growing food on waste land and so on. And that does have the virtue that it engages people. It's not a from us to you. It's not it's a different sort of relationship. I think that is interesting and something that we need to think about.
I think the point that Pete is also making is that there was a recognition, which is still referred to in Becoming a Good Food Nation, that Scottish diet has been a major issue. Scotland's had a high level of ill health that's related to diet patterns in the past, and the government took an actual plan and actually did something to investigate it and come up with something. That's even a long-term framework to some things. Is that right, Pete?
That is right, and part of the context for that is a recognition of the extremes of poverty in the west of Scotland that have historic roots, and in Dundee. Martin can tell you much more about this than I can.
Yep, okay.
Just go back to the Industrial Revolution. And so part of the very poor diet for some areas has got very, very deep roots. But there has been a recognition we need to do something about it.
Okay. Do you want to comment on...
Can I really briefly just... Because I was just thinking something I mentioned before when we were speaking was that some of these community food projects that I spoke to feel in particular quite conflicted about feeling that they need to be responding to the rise of food banks. And one in particular mentioned how he'd never previously ever questioned or doubted their purpose and their role as community development and community food projects, but that feeling as though they're being expected to step into this increasing gap in the social security net was causing the real dilemma.
Yeah, and I think I probably find it a really difficult question, because in some ways you know your own context and you don't know particularly what is strikingly different from Scotland and the rest of the UK. I think probably, Pete has mentioned specific policy. It does seem to me that the scalable size of Scotland actually means that there is an ability to do stuff in a way that connects you up with other people in other bits of government that is much, much easier than to operate at a UK level. People know one another, I think, much more effectively, which enables the possibility of a more joined-up approach around some of this work than I think is able to happen elsewhere.
I think that was a point in that slide you put up about John Boyd Orr, about the inability of individual departments to say... his report was a UK, it wasn't specific,
UK,
yes.
Right.
I think that actually may be something in that, because in my civil service days I had some experience of, well, pre-Scottish government, in those days it was slightly different. But you had a tradition, people like me would not work within one department. You would move around, you know, for two or three years you'd be in education and then you'd be in agriculture, and so there were much more cross-fertilisation, much easier to interact with other bits of the machine than it is at in the sort of, you know, the rest of the UK.
Can I also just say that that's been an experience of other social policy in Scotland? We've done some evaluations of why Scotland made so much more progress on preventative social policy and stuff. It's a lot to do with what you were just saying, that to do with size and geography.
Okay. Sorry, you're all done.
Mm-hmm.
John.
Just a very specific question on the Scottish community food movement. I recall a presentation a few years ago from Lothian Food Co-ops. Is that still alive and thriving part of this sort of initiative? And it, more generally, I mean, the food co-ops part of that.
Yes and no. What we often refer to as food co-ops aren't actual cooperatives that they describe as food cooperatives. And it goes back to Martin's point about participation. I think there's pretty range on a spectrum of how far the people who are dealing with the problems are involved in solving the problems. But I think there's a, even though these projects are not called cooperative, are called cooperatives but are not formally cooperatives, there is a cooperative ethos to a lot of them in terms of the sort of community development approach, people being allowed to participate and reciprocate in the organisation of the food distribution. So essentially some of the projects are bulk buying of food and cutting out the retail premium, essentially. So they're trying to get food to people at a more affordable price, and particularly fruit and vegetables. And still actually getting them to people, because it's, you know, it's in your majority port. You know, a mile and a half, 2 miles for people who don't have a car and can't afford the bus is actually a long way to go for fruit and veg.
More germane to what we've just been discussing, I mean, I'd tease out a bit more about this food banks as part of the problem. I don't know if there was any communications between you beforehand, but it's kind of good to hear a common message which we share really on food as justice and inequality rather than as about charity. And two of you also mentioned the idea of food as a right. But on this sort of food banks as part of the problem, I just wonder, I mean, there's one view that might say, why should somebody who goes to a food bank for emergency aid suddenly get excited about where the food comes from, and because people who can afford it don't have to think about it, and it is part of poverty, it's not part of needing to be excited about food really. But on the other hand, I have heard elsewhere in the UK that food banks are adopting this sort of active role in food production and distribution. And I just wondered if there were any other examples from Scotland where that is the case. And the other thought I had around food banks as part of the problem, and the other bit of advocacy, you might say, if you were taking a more active view of it, would be, wouldn't you get excited about food waste and supermarkets chucking stuff away, and wouldn't you, get active about that kind of stuff? And in the context of, big four supermarkets now encouraging people to donate to food banks when they're actually part of the problem in the first place, it seems to me that
you know, that there isn't an advocacy that one might expect of food banks, or might be driven by food banks, that is more fundamental than what we've got. That's one end of my story, my questions.
Any comments?
I know we talk about food banks, you know, as a general thing, and I'm sure that there are people would say there are different models of food bank, but I'd go back to what Martin said, which is that the classic model of a food bank that we have, that we talk about, is where people donate and people receive, and that's organised on a referral basis, which makes people into clients. So you're not just hungry, you're suddenly a client, implying that you have certain deficiencies, individual deficiencies that need to be fixed by yet more services. So that model does not carry within the seeds of advocacy and change. And if we want to promote advocacy and change, then we need different sorts of civil society organisations. And Naresh completely agrees with Martin that people experiencing food poverty need to be part of those organisations. And from Naresh's point of view, also people producing food need to be part of those organisations. And those are the two groups, actually, that are most frequently absent from these conversations. So we need to join up the business ends.
The other end of the spectrum of food banks as part of the problem,
I would want to say that food banks are part of the problem. I think want to say that there is an important thing going on about the generosity of people in who have found themselves involved in food banks, and actually the need for us to recognise that has opened something up of a spirit within people that actually we need to work with, and simply, you know, a model which bangs every person who puts a tin of beans in a trolley or who comes along to volunteer at a food bank is completely wrong. I think we would want to celebrate that generosity, but we would want to say, what are we doing to unpick some of that relationship so as that actually the people that you were talking about, who do find themselves as volunteers but kind of find themselves as volunteers with kind of a knot in their stomach that this isn't quite right, what do we do in order to encourage that knot in the stomach to grow into something that actually genuinely becomes a movement for change rather than simply a sticking plaster?
Well, I mean, that's the other angle of what I was going to say, because, you know, in the problem is the solution, I think, as the permaculturists say, but... You know, and if actually harnessing that generosity as in the way you describe to a more radical and aware view of what's going on, I think that is something again that we will share. The other point that there was the example of housing as expected and as a right. We have similar work where I worked in the West Midlands, and you could always get some roof over your head if you turned up as a homeless person. But as you say, the standard of it would be pretty appalling, and it would still seem to me, if one took a food analogy of that, it would still be, we'd still be providing you with something appalling. So for me, that kind of example didn't quite ring the way that I think you were trying to describe it as a food security as part of social security. the notion that you also raised of public nutrition as a public good, I think, you know, we're wholly behind that sentiment, because, you know, as we demonstrated, I think, in the interim report, the societal costs of poor nutrition fall on everybody. I was reminded with the Boydor example of another Scot, Dougal Baird, who showed that, you know, after the Second World War, that there was a great fall in stillbirth and infant deaths, which had happened so rapidly it couldn't be attributed to anything that the doctors were doing, but was certainly it could be attributed to food rationing that actually enabled everybody to have a particularly pregnant mothers to have a decent diet. So I think that notion of public good is a very important one.
Thanks. No comments on that one?
No, I'm just saying the example of housing, absolutely. but it was to illustrate that within something which is the quintessential,
yeah,
you know, engine of capitalism in the UK,
yeah,
you can still have a framework of rights in relation to housing. Because people will say, well, how could you have the right to food, because then people would all get it for nothing? Well,
yeah,
it's trying to change the framework. And, you know, with both education and with health, which is seen as public goods, part of the policy objective used to be, I hope still is, that we're trying to reduce the differentials which would exist if you had a pure market system between people who have reasonable incomes and people who have low incomes. You know, so the educational outcomes, the health outcomes are less, there's less of a gap than there would be if we just left it to the market, whereas with food we're quite content just leave it to the market.
Okay, what I'd like to do next is ask you, Kate, if you've got any comments or things you'd like to share with us. But before I do that, I'd like to read all of you the key questions that we put out. And after Kate has said, if you've thoughts on that, or also, gosh, they're not the key questions, this is the key question, or one of the key questions, let us know. And we've kind of put this out, we're encouraging people to address the key question to parliamentary candidates, which is how can you make universal access to nutritious, affordable food a political priority? Because we're not convinced it is a political priority at the moment. How do you do that if you're a politician? Beyond that, we had a set of follow-up questions. I'm not going to talk about the rationale for them, because you can read that and you'll see it in a shorter time. One is, what is the role of emergency food provision in addressing hunger and food poverty in the UK? Should we accept it as a permanent feature of society? I feel I know your answer to that. The next one was thinking about access and affordability. What actions are needed by whom to ensure more people in low-income households have access to affordable, nutritious food? The next one is a much more complex issue, because it starts to recognise the complexity. And also, one of our findings is that, you know, the price of food is going to go up in time, because it doesn't include the environmental costs, doesn't include the big changes that happen in the world, etc., etc. So how should we balance the need for affordable food on the one hand with concerns over environmental damage, bad working conditions and long-term health costs associated with intensive farming and bad diets on the other? This is a really heart of the questions that we're going to have to address in the future, because it's going to be a big issue. The next one we had is it right that big food brands are able to influence food choices and increase sales of sugary, salty, fatty foods through advertising? And what should the role of government be in promoting more healthy diet? And this comes very much out of the hearing we had, which I think was number two, where we had John Alexander, a former advertising executive, talking to us. And there's quite a bit in the report about it. You might want to look at that. And the final question, and I think, again, I may have some sense of your answer on this one, is... it's on the right to food. How can we meet this commitment to respect, protect and fulfil the right to food, and how should we see that it is enforced? Because as of the evidence we've had, again, is that the UK is a signatory to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights International Covenant, which includes in it those three elements: to respect, to protect and fulfil the right to food.
and we've had very strong evidence on that from some of our people. So think about that while we're here. Well, you've probably all thought about it now, and let's have any inputs from you, Kate. That would be very grateful, and perhaps say a little bit more about you and the background.
Okay, where to start?
I know.
Picking up on your last point, I'm delighted to hear you talking about government's responsibility to respect, protect and fulfil human rights, which obviously includes the right to food. And the context of that is that although I found out about tonight's hearing through my work with Faith and Community Scotland, where I am a volunteer officer with the Tackling Poverty Together project, and I know that I'm going to talk to some people about the work there after this, I'm actually here in my own right as somebody who was a long-term community campaigner with many years of first-hand experience of living in poverty, who helped to co-found a local anti-poverty organisation in the West End of Glasgow called West Glasgow Against Poverty, and I worked there for 14 years. And I'm now finishing off, I'm now an academic activist, and I'm finishing off writing up my PhD on the potential for an anti-poverty human rights culture in Scotland and why it matters. So I'm here today wearing those other hats, and I'll switch to my fixed hat afterwards. So I wasn't anticipating actually saying something, so I'm afraid I was jotting down a few points that I might want to make while your colleague was making a point. And so can I just clarify something that you said when you spoke, if that's all right? Sorry, Peter, is it?
Andrew. Yeah.
So I have a terrible memory for meeting people's names. It takes me ages to remember them. I think it's an age thing. Did you say, and correct me if I picked you up wrongly, that you felt that people weren't literally starving and we were talking about relative rather than absolute poverty?
Yes, I think for me the issue is more about the quality of the diet than an actual absence of food. But
okay.
if I'm wrong, I'm happy for you to correct that.
I have to say to you that many instances, and for quite a period of time, you are wrong. There are people literally starving. There is an increasing number of people literally starving. During the time where I worked in the anti-poverty organisation that I talked about, which was several years, we would have people coming to us in that situation. It has exponentially increased in line, obviously, with the development of food banks. You've heard the evidence here. Many people go to food bank as an act of desperation. It does not meet their needs, but many people do not go anywhere near it, and many people, even when they do go near it, are already at the point of starving. People are starving in this country. I don't think you will find an anti-poverty worker or somebody who is working on the front line who will deny that. That is incontrovertible evidence. And we are not only talking about relative poverty, important though that is, because as we know, as you know, the median income has declined and the measures by which we measure relative poverty have changed,
that was precisely what I was trying to get at, that in terms of relative poverty, we talk about, and I mean, I'm glad you're confirming that as far as food is concerned, it's not simply a relative poverty. There is, I mean, again, back to the 30s argument or context, you know, again, my mother used to tell me, you know, children went barefoot in the streets. We don't see children barefoot in the streets literally, but what you seem to be saying is that the food equivalent of that is still there, that there is still genuine shortage of actual food, no matter what quality and what the nature of it is, but people literally going to bed hungry in this country, whereas in other aspects of relative poverty, at least there is a baseline, and then there are gradations within that. But I think if that is the case for food, then that is, you know, that is particularly worrying that, and again, I think it's a point that was made over here, that in other aspects of life, you know, there are other things or there are other safety nets or whatever, but why food is so sort of specific in this context?
And actually, as somebody who sees food poverty as something that is about poverty, I don't think it is about food poverty or food justice or even child poverty. I mean, I think somebody made a wonderful quote at the Beyond Food Banks conference where people speaking and when I facilitated a workshop, somebody made a wonderful quote that if you have money, then you will always eat. And it is about income poverty and it's about lack of a proper functioning democracy in this country where the poor, many people who are classed as the poor, do not have a political voice. And I do think that things would be different if people who are living on, for example, on benefits were able to actually be mobilised and go out to vote more, because I think part of the reason my attention is not paid to their needs is because they do not have a political voice. And many people will say that the deserving poor, who up till now have been seen as pensioners, very often are taken heed of in terms of government policy because they vote. So I'm sort of digressing slightly there. The point I was making about relative poverty is that even relative poverty is not being accurately measured if we actually compare levels now with previous years, because the measures have changed. But what I am saying, there is absolute poverty in this country. There has been absolute poverty in this country for a long time, and I know this because I've been working in a grassroots community advice and support service for many years before I moved into my current role. There was absolute poverty then, but now it is shocking the levels of absolute poverty in this country. I mean, the evidence is just, you know, that it's insurmountable. I mean, it's incontrovertible. The evidence is absolutely stacked up. So I do not think that we have to prove anything anymore. I am in the situation where I think if people don't want to hear the evidence, it's because they don't want to see and they don't want to hear. There is a massive amount of evidence. There is shocking absolute poverty in this country. When people are sanctioned, they have nothing. We're not talking about people's benefit being stopped and they go and take a wee bit of money out of the bank, or they go and turn to their family. People have nothing, literally nothing. And it's not just about food. It's about clothing, it's about fuel, and yes, it is about housing. Even though that right does exist in theory in this country, obviously the difference between a right in theory and a right in practice isn't always the same. I mean, even when I was working in Westcap, the organisation I talked about, I remember a shocking case when I realised that somebody came and needed access to a hostel. I hadn't been working as an advice number for a number of years. I was working as a development worker. I took on the advice worker's role and I phoned up thinking that I'd have the facilities that I'd had just maybe a couple of years before. And I was told if they got there before 4 o'clock, they might be able to get them sitting in a chair with a blanket in the Salvation Army hostel so they could sit up all night with a blanket around them. And that was a number of years ago, and things have not got better because they've closed down the large-scale hostels without putting in the provision for actually food replacement. So it's not just about food, and I know the focus here that you have about food is why you're here, and I'm delighted that it's food and poverty and not food poverty, but it is about poverty and all its manifestations. I walk along the streets where I live, and I see, and I'm sure everybody here who actually is dealing with people who are living in poverty or living in areas where people are impoverished, the despair in people's faces is shocking. It's shocking. I mean, there are days, and I'm not exaggerating, when I have difficulty getting out of bed because the sheer enormity of it, and I'm not exaggerating, just hits me. It's absolutely shocking. So I really just wanted to pick up on that point. And a more sort of general thing, I was really interested in the question about the specific things in Scotland that may be different. My own research involved, as I said, I'm writing it up at the moment, but involved interviewing, amongst other things, 40 opinion formers in Scottish society that were comprised of politicians, of people from the media, of church leaders, of business leaders, of trade unionists, of academics, of entertainers who were active in political debates. And one of the things that I was asking them about was the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Because I would say when I was an anti-poverty activist, I was absolutely astounded when I discovered that this covenant existed, that our government had signed it in 1976 and nobody knew about it. And I was immediately thinking, well, how come I didn't know about this? I'm an informed person. I've been campaigning in poverty for years. So my own thesis was about how common is that? Is my impression of that right? Is there empirical evidence, one, to show that people don't know about it? And two, how do people feel when they find out about it? Overwhelmingly of the people that I interviewed in Scotland, who many of whom did not know about it, but overwhelmingly people were interested in it. The questions about implementing it were about how we do it rather than should we do it. And people were very, very supportive of looking at a way to implement and to domesticate the rights in that covenant, which, as we know, do not just include the right to an adequate standard of living, but picking up in some other points, also include the right to work and to just and favourable conditions of work. So obviously that would link in with the conditions that we're talking about within the food industry that may be issues, and the right to social security. Now, the right to food taken in isolation, yes, can be seen as a problem, but if the right to an adequate standard of living is actually allied with the right to work and just the favourable conditions of work, and also the right to social security, then that becomes a different ballgame, when you're actually looking at all these things together. And there is a different human rights culture in many places in Scotland. That's where I'm going about the difference. Over and over and over again in my work, I hear from different people who are not talking to each other that human rights are, quote, toxic down south. I continually hear that. Now, you'll be better placed to know what your opinion of that is than me, but I have heard that so many times. I'm not saying what's happening here in Scotland is perfect, but the rhetoric that's coming from the Scottish Government is very pro-human rights. We now, as you know, have a Scottish National Action Plan on human rights, which is calling for the domestication of the covenant and economic, social and cultural rights, amongst others. And that had cross-party support in the Scottish Parliament. So there is a lot of, there is potential here, I believe, for actually looking at a rights-based approach, perhaps more readily than at the moment that there is in other parts of the UK. And I do think that we could be that beacon that we could have been told about, that we could be a beacon of progressive policies. I do think there is a potential for an anti-poverty human rights culture, and my research is about that. The other things, if I'm not talking too much, I wanted to pick up on. The other thing I just really wanted to say, a comment on the Feeding Britain report, and just to say how concerned I am about that in relation to what we're talking about. I know there are many people here who will share that concern. I'm particularly concerned about the narrative in it, the cultural narrative that it's trying to promote, because I think changing the cultural narrative is the key, perhaps, to some of what we're talking about. It actually says, as most of you will know who have read it, actually says explicitly that government cannot meet the need to feed its own people. It actually states that. It actually quotes research from Victorian times in support of its argument, as if somehow nothing has happened since, you know, Booth produced his work and so on. It's shocking in the way that it actually produces research. It's not a good piece of research. And also what really troubles me is, as well tying in with your point, about food waste and so on, as we know, it's advocating that food waste should go to feed the poor. I mean, it's utterly unbelievable. It talks about applying to the European Fund for the Most Deprived, which I didn't even know existed until I read this, to set up this network for Feeding Britain. So we are actually acknowledging that we have people who are called the most deprived who actually need this network set up for them. But then it doesn't talk about even running that network and subsidising that network from that fund. As you know, it talks about this network being independent of government, quote. It's one of the most shocking and scary documents I have ever read. So I just wanted to say that. And the very last point, which picks up in the cultural narrative, is also picking up in the language. We need a change of language. Somebody made the point at the Beyond Food Banks conference that we need to call them something different from food banks. It's making them sort of seem normal and sort of something that they're not. Somebody else, I'm not sure if it was Pete or somebody else who was speaking, talked about this idea of dependency and said that the real dependency, this is government dependency. Government is abdicating its responsibility for the well-being of its people, which is what it's meant to be for, to the generosity of people. And one of the shameful things in Feeding Britain is it plays on that and talks about how wonderful people are who are doing this and how we should really enshrine that generosity somewhere. I think it's utterly shocking. But the very last thing on that is that this is produced by the all-party parliamentary group on hunger. Now, I tussled with, why is that so awful? Because it was just, I had an immediate reaction to it, and I suddenly realised it's like talking about torture and having an all-party parliamentary group in pain. You know, how we deal with the pain, how we manage pain, maybe even how we stop people feeling the pain. But nevertheless, we're not talking about what it is that's causing the pain. It's poverty that's causing it. It's not hunger, it's poverty that is the issue. And so I think that we need a change in cultural narrative. We need to really look at the language. And we also, picking up on the point, really need to take a rights-based approach to it. And I celebrate, once again, Nourish for taking the lead and the Right to Food campaign.
Thank you. I do hope you will consider giving further evidence when you've had a chance to read the report and reflect on these and put in. And that goes for all of you. We're very keen to focus on actions. By whom, by when, doing what? Whether it's local to national government or whether it's CAP reform, as was mentioned, and others. Now, it's 8:30, and we said we'd finish at 8:30. If you're willing to pop on for a few more minutes and would like to give any response to those questions, we'd be delighted to extend for a few more minutes, if that's all right, if that's okay with you. Do you want to give any feedback on the kind of questions that we've raised? Or if you think there's a missing question that we really ought to be focusing on, let us know. Anyone want to kick off with
that?
Well, thank you so much, Kate.
I will go for... it's not necessarily a missing question, or maybe it is a missing question. I do think that issue of saying those who experience food poverty need to be at the heart of the solution. So I would certainly want to say, is there a question here that actually takes that fact much more seriously, and is then saying, you know, what is the role, or how can we ensure in the development of this that we deliberately involve people who are experiencing food poverty? I think maybe of those questions, and they're all fascinating, but of those questions, I think the one that I would want to pick up on is this balancing thing about the fact that actually, as we begin to take the environmental cost of food into account, we're going to end up with higher priced food. I don't know the answer to that at all, I'm afraid, but I do think that what is of fundamental importance is that we begin developing the solutions around that, involving those who are poorest first. Because I think if we don't do that, we fall into the notion that if we can get it solved for this group of people, we can then have a trickle-out model of solving the problem. And all of our understanding about trickle-out strategies is that they never actually trickle out far enough. So I think our challenge is to say that is the reality that we're faced with. How do we develop solutions that work first and foremost for the poorest and most marginalised in our society, knowing that if actually we can do something there, we then have a model that can trickle in to others who will naturally be able to make some of those links more effectively. So that would be a question I would really encourage the Commission to be grappling with and thinking about over the next period of time. It's a long-term one, but we need to do the work now, and we need to have a pro-poor view of how we address the issue.
Thank you.
Brian,
do you want to say?
I'm not sure I have anything in particular to add.
That's fine, we're not pushing.
I'm not sure. I think the point that's been made a lot about changing the narrative and whether the issue of food, which has obviously galvanised a huge amount of public concern, and so I'm not sure if there's a need for an additional question around it, but the point that you've raised about how we can capture that but shift the focus and keep the, yeah. And I think that there is whilst there's lots of media headlines that are, I think the shame of food banks is something that people feel quite strongly about, the sense that in the same way that people tend to think we want to protect the NHS and we don't want food banks in Britain, people do seem quite anxious about that. So whether we get to the stage where the supermarkets advertising good products to give to food banks, everyone having fundraisers and charity drives that are giving to a food bank will still grate the way it does with me and a lot of people who notice these things.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it would be great if the Commission could find some fresh language, because I do think that what happens is our public discourse on this subject keeps falling into the same ruts. So you have a discourse around, a foodie discourse around, where's the newest restaurant, and isn't it nice they've got handmade crabs or whatever it is. There's that discourse that goes on. And then there's a discourse about teaching the poor to cook and about fecklessness, which is as old as the hills, but it pops out. You have conversations. It appears in the media constantly. It appears in the food bank, in the APPG report, and people slide into that conversation. and they slide into other conversations about food because they're well worn. You know, they know how to do that conversation. So we have the same conversation over and over again. And your point about how do you put this up the political agenda, I don't know, because if you want to say Britain is not educating its young people well enough to compete in the global marketplace, you know, people, you know, pompous men spend a lot of time listening to those sorts of words, right? But Britain is not feeding its kids well enough to grow up and be the height they could be, or be the weight they could be, or be as healthy as could be, or live as long as they could live. That's of no interest to people. And that's a bizarre thing to me. You know, that we can't seem to get a discourse about what would it be like to be a healthy society where actually you, as a child born in a poor household, your life chances approach something like a child born in a rich household. I mean, you know, people just don't want to have that conversation. We need to have that very different conversation. And I agree, poverty is the root of this, but food's a very tangible, visceral part of this. And there is nothing as bad as being hungry. You know, and you're absolutely right. There are people who are feeling hunger pains week after week. And when the Gallup report comes out, the Gallup World Poll on household food insecurity comes out, let's hope the UK gets a wake-up call. Because what that will show...
What is that project then?
There's been a food insecurity experience scale that's been developed and been in use in the States for years. So if you go on the website in the States, you can look at food insecurity levels in Alabama or Minnesota or wherever. But Gallup have tested that methodology with the FAO in 8 countries around the world and validated it. And they've now rolled that out to 140 countries as part of their world poll. And those results are going to come out second quarter of 2015. And my guess is that they won't be disaggregated probably within the UK to regions, but you'll probably see them on an 8-point scale. You'll see food insecurity levels of 10 to 12% in the UK. And there are questions like, have you fed your children things you'd rather not because you can't afford to feed them better? Have you skipped a meal? Have you gone out with food for a whole day, you know, because you've run out of money? Do you worry every week about running out of money for food? So very simple, straightforward questions, and the answer to that, my guess would be 10% of the households in the UK are food insecure. And that's not counting food bank users, that's just the population. So all I'm saying is it'd be great if the Commission could come up with some new language and some new conversation. I think Martin's point about involving people, you know, in generating the solution is absolutely right. And I think Marianne's point about the importance of, and Martin said this too, about the importance of community in all this is absolutely right. I think the most horrific thing about the Feeding Britain report to me was this idea of a sort of state machinery, you know, state-operated food banks, essentially, but not state-backed, but just sort of state-sanctioned. So, whereas if there is going to, you know, part of the change has to be about a better framework of government, but genuine empowerment for people and for communities to find community-based solutions to some of this. And we've got to get those two things working together: better incomes for people, but also power in people's hands, not just people being given food.
Yeah. Well, look, thank you all. The notes I had kind of written on the side as you went through, that I kind of headline points was, food's not a national disaster, the state we're in, it's a man-made and socially constructed problem we've got. It's a wake-up call. We actually should have a clear target to end food banks by 2020 and celebrate the closure of every food bank. Nutrition should be seen as a public good, and social security includes food security. And it's not a charity, it's a right. I think some of the key points from Marianne was about the whole issue around stigma and shame that people don't connect. It ties into what Simon Maxwell wrote in the mid-90s about fear as being one of the key issues in food insecurity, is the sense of fear and undermining your well-being. We need to change the language and practice, and this challenge to take advantage of the volunteers' goodwill, but also the unease about having to use the goodwill for the purposes they're using it in meeting food needs, because it shouldn't be, and which again you picked up on, kind of justice, not charity. Again, don't institutionalise food banks. I think there's a question I on CAB view, and actually, you know, the CAB is actually very well trained volunteers, supported by professionals, but very poorly funded, with very
iffy funding, and that's a system we've got that could be used and supported, but is it getting a problem? And I think, Martin, you're a very powerful case that you made, and a key that we the poor must engage and be empowered in this process and work from that position. And we have tried in our small way to do this through the people we're working with in Manchester, through Neil, who can't be here tonight. And I think the other thing is about also celebrating the fact that food is a celebration of human creativity and community, and where people come together around food, the skills that they're around. If we pace this as all as something that is just dismal, it actually disempowers everybody, and it's something that we have to connect. But also this issue about who's benefiting from charitable acts, the giver or the receiver, or the government, and abdicating responsibility. So I think those are really important ones. I think the interesting, you know, the differences you point to in Scotland and the culture in Scotland and the attitude to rights and the attitude to the covenants, really interesting, Kate. And I think it is probably very different from what you, certainly what you tear down.
I wouldn't want to overstate that, though. Obviously there are.
Yeah. But I think it's that. And we've got to go beyond food banks and so forth. So, look, thank you all. I think one of the issues that comes out when you talk about scalability in Scotland that we maybe need to address is about the issue about regional action, devolved action, not just in Scotland, but throughout the polity that is the United Kingdom still. So thank you all very much.
For the moment.
Yes, I'm not going into that event. I am married to a Scot and I went to Aberdeen University. My daughter's living in Edinburgh. Thank you all very much for taking your time coming tonight and sharing with us. I hope you'll continue to input, and I hope you won't be too disappointed that we don't meet everything when we produce the final report. We'll do our best. But the final report is not the end of the process. It's something we hope will be fed into the processes that you're engaged with and we want to follow up with after it's out. This is why we're also been trying to be very transparent throughout this whole proceedings, putting your evidence online, make it accessible, let people get involved. Thank you.
If the tape
is
officially turned off, officially.
Which
no, I don't mind it. I'm just saying officially.